The Business Bunker with Paul Andrews.
Welcome back to the Business Bunker Show here on channelradio.co.uk/2 and bizradio.co.uk on this Tuesday the 24th of July. You're listening to me, Paul Andrews, and my co-host, Mr. Marvis Martin. Wait.
Hi, everyone.
Good. Welcome back. I've got some things to tell you about. There's a new thing happening, and this is quite exciting. Ooh. It's the speakers platform. Be seen and be heard. And it's taking place on Friday the 31st of August from 6 p.m. until 10 p.m. And it's taking place in the fantastic Fruitworks in Canterbury. I would say that, wouldn't I? Are you a speaker? Would you like to practice your speaking skills? Would you like to use your skills to win a competition, giving you the chance to improve your speaking and helping you to elevate yourself as a professional speaker? Then you should join us at the speakers platform on Friday the 31st of August. We'd like to hear your business journey, your highs and your lows, your successes and your failures. All participants will be in with a chance to speak in front of the prestigious judges and the audience with the possibility of winning the overall competition. Here's the process. You enter your interest in taking part. You submit a snippet of your intended talk content as the qualifying part of the competition with a profile picture and a short bio. Okay. You book on the event. It's just 15 quid to book on the event. Okay. And the judges will choose four finalists from all of the submitted talks, and they will not be announced until the evening. So you're going to turn up and you don't know whether you're going to talk or not. Okay. These finalists will then each get to do their talk. The audience and judge will then vote for their favourite speaker, and the overall winner will be decided and announced on the night. And the prize for the overall winner will be one-to-one coaching with each of the judges, who will share with you ways to improve your speaking and how to earn money as a professional speaker.
Who are the judges?
I'll come to that in a moment. Oh. A video. You'll also get a video of your talk for the night, fully edited and ready to use as part of your speaker reel, and a few other extras thrown in. And the your submission must be submitted by the 21st of August, and to submit it, you have to email Amanda at butterfliesbusinessevents.co.uk. That's Amanda at butterfliesbusinessevents.co.uk. The three judges are international professional speaker Zoe Cairns, former international professionally paid speaker, me, and the lovely Jane Farnham. And Jane is the CEO of Great British Speakers. It's a speaker bureau. So three very useful judges, well, two useful than me, two useful judges talking about how to become a professional speaker and get paid to speak.
Brilliant.
So do get involved in that. It's going to be great fun, and it's going to be really good. Cool. It's not easy to get paid to speak anymore.
No, I bet. It's very difficult to capture people's attention on a kind of stage like that, isn't it?
Yeah. There's all kinds of issues about getting how you get paid to do it. Back in my, I was a paid speaker for 15 years on the international circuit, and basically, you need to either be famous, which I'm not, you know, so an ex-sports star or something, and then they'll pay you silly money to just rock up.
CEO of a big branded company like Apple.
Yeah, possibly, although a lot of them don't actually get paid to speak because they're there representing their company, yeah. Most of us that got paid to speak got paid because we sold tickets. And that was, you know, people had heard of us or wanted to hear about what we were talking about, so they would buy a ticket. And that's why the organisers would pay you, because they knew that you could sell tickets.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, for instance...
So you had a network, for example, that you could tap into and...
Yeah, yeah. Or a reputation. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And all of my speaking gigs, every single one of them for 15 years, I got through word of mouth. Mm. You know, you'd speak somewhere and... invariably, at the end of it, somebody would come up to you and say, can I book you to speak at one of my events? Oh, yeah.
Good. Cool. I haven't heard you speak for a while.
Nah, I've had a sore throat, mate.
Got a man flu, hasn't he?
Yeah, yeah. I did speak recently. I was at the University of Kent.
Yeah? What did you speak about?
Construction industry, skill shortages. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I cemented... Nah, I won't go there.
Yeah, seamless joint there,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Right, Kent B2B Medway, Thursday the 20th of September. So it's at the Chatham Historic Dockyard. I think it's at number 3 Slip, which I'm not sure it's actually been in that building before, but it's a fabulous facility down there. So this is the final Chamber Business to Business Expo of the year. So it's Thursday, the 20th of September. You can obviously go as a kind of day delegate.
Have you got a stand?
I have got a stand. I'll come on to that.
Cool.
And it's free to go. So you can register for free at kent-b2b.co.uk. You can obviously exhibit there, which we are doing in conjunction with the lovely people at Kent Space, but their Chatham office this time, and also Linda Garcia from Aluxi Consulting. Or you can actually become a sponsor. I think you could sponsor the event as well. So all of the information about that is at kent-b2b.co.uk, and we look forward to seeing you there on Thursday the 20th of September.
Fantastic. Cool. I've just had a really interesting tweet. I've not had one like this before. It's from a lady called Helen Caddick. Caddick Helen on the Twitter, C-A-D-D-I-C-K. And she says, hello, Vanilla Web and Business Bunker. Can you give a shout out, please, for the London premiere of my opera?
Wow.
Hey, how about that? It's Amphora O is the opera, and that's also a Twitter handle. Amphora, A-M-P-H-O-R-A-O. Inspired by Dada, featuring music, dance, costume. It will be performed at Tate a Tate, Europe's largest opera festival, on Saturday the 18th of August at 7 p.m. And she has provided a link for tickets, and of course Twitter has kindly shortened it, so I can't read the link. So you'll have to follow her on Twitter, Helen Caddick, and her Twitter handle is Caddick Helen, and find out about the opera, what she wrote. Wow, brilliant. Never had an opera before. Fantastic. Right. Well, good luck with that, Helen. I hope it's a rip-roaring, massive success for you.
We were talking about collaboration earlier.
We were, Adrian.
We were.
And you says we're always talking about collaboration.
Absolutely.
So there is another collaborative after-hours networking event happening at Dartford Football Club, on Thursday the 13th of September. So this follows on from an event that we created in conjunction with Jarman's.
Yeah, that's in my diary.
Brilliant. And Metro Bank and Brian's Business Networking, BBN, a couple of months ago. We decided to, it was a huge success, so we had about 100 businesses in the room. So we've decided to make it a kind of regular feature on the After Hours Networking calendar. So the next one is Thursday the 13th of September. There'll be a lovely, sumptuous buffet again, which is the only reason I go, really. as I'm paying for it.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. You might as well eat it then.
but actually, no, there's some great networking as well, obviously, on the evening. So there is an Eventbrite booking link. It's really long. I'll never be able to read it out and you remember it. So have a look on our community page in Supply My Business, After Hours Networking, Dartford Football Club, Thursday the 13th September, 6 p.m. Adrian's going to be there.
I will be.
Fantastic.
I know Jay will be there.
And I will probably be.
And you're coming as well. Superb.
Fantastic.
It's down to you now, David.
I'm going to have to be there.
Yeah, yeah. You can't not be, really. Yeah, it's the place to be, David.
Paul, you don't have to be there.
No, I'm not coming.
You've been invited.
No, I wanted to come, but he wouldn't let me. They said they'd sold out and they had no more tickets left. Do you want to introduce our next guest?
I'd love to. Is it Emma? Emma, are you going next?
If you like.
Brilliant. Okay. So Emma Lee from Jarman Solicitors. So Emma joined Jarman's fairly recently, actually,
yeah,
wasn't it? 3 months ago,
something like that.
Gosh. Yeah. So a bit of a whirlwind induction, because obviously, for those of you that don't know, Jarman's, I think, has gone from something like 12 solicitors 18 months ago to, what is it?
Less than that, just over a year ago.
Just over a year ago to, what, over 50 now?
Something like that, yeah.
I need babbits.
Exactly. With an office in Chancery Lane as well.
Yes, as well as Sittingbourne, yeah.
Yeah. Mm. And Emma, you'd spent a lot of time working in one firm, I think, hadn't you, for many years?
Yeah.
So
we're shall remain nameless.
Nameless. But you were enticed to join Jay and the growing team. And your specialism is employment law.
Employment and civil litigation, which is why I was getting so excitable about debt recovery and cash flow issues. But yes, employment is my primary focus at the moment.
Brilliant.
He may have said this. Do you work in litigation as well?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So tell us a little bit about you and the practice that you run and the kind of general things that you see. Employment law is one of those things where there's a huge amount of myths in it. There's a huge, for small employers, a lot of fear, in employment about doing the wrong thing and saying the wrong thing. And just from my own point of view as someone that runs a recruitment portal, there's also a lot of people that don't have the right level of fear.
That's true.
That do incredibly headstrong things, especially when they write job adverts.
Oh, yes.
So from your point of view as a practice, and I know you've only been there a few months, but generally you've got lots of experience in this, what are the kind of things that most often come to your attention?
A lot of it revolves around dismissals and how they're handled.
Yeah.
Invariably not very well. The primary issue, and I think David would probably agree with me, with when it comes to HR, when it comes to dealing with employees, is communication is absolutely key. And invariably, it's one of the things that business owners really struggle with, particularly when it comes to small businesses, where they're not relying on an HR person or an HR department, and they're trying to do it all themselves. They struggle with communication, and that's a really key area when it comes to staff and explaining to people why it is that you want them to do certain things, why it is you want them to do them in a particular way, and then invariably people get upset, and that's when relationships break down and dismissals happen. Generally speaking, communication is the biggest issue, and I deal with the fallout from there.
It's interesting, isn't it? Many years ago, like 20-odd years ago, I actually won an industrial tribunal as an employer.
It does happen.
Which is almost unheard of. Yeah.
I'm surprised.
And the interesting thing is that the reason that I won is that the person that had been dismissed, during the dismissal process, I actually asked them to take notes. And she had written down in a notebook all of the things that we discussed. And when she was finally dismissed, she claimed that it was, you know, she'd never been consulted and da-da-da-da-da. And we got to the tribunal and I just produced her own notebook in her own handwriting, and that was the end of that, really. But even so, laughing aside, it was still a detriment to my business because certainly back then, and I think it's probably still the same now, I don't get any of my costs for going through that. So it was a year of heartache and messing about and playing about and, you know, arguing and being horrible and running up lawyers' fees and all the rest of it. Yeah. So there is no winners, basically.
No, there isn't. And very often with employers in particular, when you are successful, it's a bit of a Pyrrhic victory because although you haven't had to pay out damages, as you rightly say, although there is a discretion available to judges to utilise costs orders, that's not a discretion that they use
very often. And even as an employee, you don't really want to. You don't want to hammer someone, you know, because there's no way they could ever pay your legal fees because they couldn't afford it because they're unemployed.
Not always. Sometimes they've got themselves another job in between times. But yeah, you're right. It does become a... It's a bit of an issue, you know, and it's management time as well. It's not just the cost that you're running up.
You
spend loads of time putting witness statements together, pitching up for a 2-3 day trial.
Yeah.
It's all time out of your business, and you need to be focusing on that, not dealing with you know, the person that you got rid of 18 months ago.
Yeah. The law seems to have changed a bit, though, doesn't it, in favour of employers over the last few years. I remember when I was working in London, I mean, things like, for example... You had to, if you'd been working somewhere for 2 years, I think, that you couldn't automatically be dismissed.
It went down. So it started at 2 years, then it went down to a year, then it went back up to two.
Right.
So we're back up to two at the moment. Mm-hmm. So you need to have 2 years' service under your belt before you can bring claims. In terms of unfair dismissal, that doesn't apply to all styles of claim.
I was going to say, because there are quite a few claims that you can claim from day one. Racism and sexism and things
all
like that.
All the discriminations, trade union stuff, that sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. So from your point of view, Emma, as an employer, what are the kind of recommendations that you would give to someone just embarking on starting to employ their first group of people as employees?
Starting out, the most important thing you can do is get yourself an employment contract. So few do. And it's one of the things that you can do relatively cheaply. Some will download them from the internet. They're a bit of a worry, as with everything. If you Google it, you know, there will be something there, but it doesn't mean to say that it's current. And there are plenty of things that can cause you a problem if you go down that path.
I have told this story a few times, but I'll tell you. many years ago, well, not that many years ago, actually, when I set up my prison company, I employed someone, and they were about the 30th person I'd employed, and I gave them their contract of employment, and they actually read it, and they rang me up, and they went, in the contract, it says fair internet usage policy and the rules on internet usage. Yep. And they went, but I can't find it in the contract. I went, oh, okay. So I rang my office manager and I went, it's not in the contract. And they went, well, I've never seen it.
You're not alone.
So I asked everybody that had signed it and they went, oh, I've never seen that. And I didn't actually have one.
No, and an awful lot of businesses will have references to all sorts of things in handbooks and stuff, and they've never had a handbook before. So, yeah, I you're not alone by any stretch of the imagination. I see that a lot. Yeah. And handbooks is my second tip. Get a handbook. It benchmarks everything. So it gives your staff a clear indication of what it is that you're expecting from them. And it can be as simple as what you expect in the event of extreme weather, the snow. Not that we're thinking about that right now. But you know,
melting tarmac,
but heat as well, I guess. Yeah,
melting tarmac at the moment. That's if you can't get into work because the road has melted.
Your tyres have melted into
shredded.
The tarmac. Yeah. So you know, in those sorts of circumstances, what you would do in terms of pay and what they can expect in terms of, you know, whether that be used for holiday or sick or whatever.
So those two things go hand in hand.
They do. They do. They're very important, and they, as I say, they set the infrastructure for your employment relationship.
It's really interesting, isn't it? Because all of those kind of things. Professional support, accountants, lawyers, HR contracts, insurance, all those kind of things. When people look at it with small, early stage businesses, they all go, can't afford that. And I was the same when I was first starting my business. Oh, I can't afford all that nonsense, all that mussing about, you know, all that. I might not be here in 3 months' time. I'll not spend money and all that. Over time, you realize how valuable it is to have that in place from day one. And you know, that as a business person myself, that is my advice to everybody. Do not scrimp on any of those things, because if you get them in place in the first place, you're home and dry for most things forever on. I mean, okay, you're gonna have to tinker with them over time, but you would anyway. But people scrimp on it, you know. They go, well, I've had people that have asked me to invest in a business, and I go, right, have you got insurance? They go, no, we're not going to bother with insurance for the moment. You go, really? Oh, really? Okay.
It's crazy. And the same applies to terms and conditions. You know, when you're setting up and you're doing sales or whatever, the amount of people that don't have any terms and conditions at all about what they expect their customers to pay, even when they expect their customers to pay, is incredible. I bet you see that all the time.
Absolutely,
don't you?
Yeah.
It's the infrastructure is so important, and employment contracts definitely go part of that.
I want to steer the conversation in a slightly different direction.
Sorry.
Now. I want to talk about the gig economy, because you've just written us a brilliant blog.
I did.
About,
I'm not sure about brilliant, but it was definitely a blog.
Are you a worker or are you self-employed? Mm. So, for the benefit of everybody listening who may be employing temporary staff, or maybe thinks they're employing people who are actually self-employed, but they may not be. Can you just sort of clarify for us where the law currently sits with regard to the gig economy?
I can answer that. No, she can't, because nobody's got a bloody clue. That's why.
Well, a bit like Chupi, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
There has been a fairly high-profile case recently with Pimlico
Plumbers.
Yeah. So let Emma tell us.
Before Emma answers that, though, because it's one of my pet things, this.
Or is it? Oh, no.
Yeah, it's one of my big pet things, this. It's another area of law which the government have completely screwed up, because there are no definitive things. I went to a seminar on IR35 in the building industry, and the guy from HMRC kept saying, well we don't really know, we'd have to go to court to find that out. And she's like, really, this is pointless. Sorry,
no, Emma, no, too. You're right, and ED is a really difficult test. So I mean, the difference between an employer and a work employee and a worker, generally speaking, is set out in statute. There is a lot of blurred lines between what the statute says in the Employment Rights Act and then what happens in terms of self-employment. And the gig economy is just this beautiful microcosm of that grey area. Insofar as the gig economy basically being those sorts of businesses, Uber, Pimlico Plumbers, where they don't have staff that are employed 9 till 5, Monday to Friday. They pay them per gig is the idea. So they pay them per job. So a lot of the delivery companies and those sorts of things. So the issue then arises whereby the business that's engaging those people are saying, well, they're self-employed, they're doing it for themselves, they're setting up their own tax, we don't have anything to do with that. From the employee, I use the word worker, because invariably they are workers. They are there doing a job. It is, generally speaking, fairly exclusive. And there is a sort of master-servant arrangement, which is really where the law started, this master-servant idea. And then, as I say, because of the way that business goes, and we try and blur the lines deliberately so that we can get away with not having to pay the additional national insurance and everything else, we've got to this position where people are trying to say that they are brokering arrangements. Uber is the prime example of that. They're just there to broker the relationship between the fare and the cabbie, not as a direct employer or as a...
That's a new one on me. I've not heard that term before.
Broker the arrangement.
Yeah. No, that's... So Uber is a broker.
Yeah. They've always argued that from day one, that they don't provide taxi services. They provide a platform to put you in touch with people that provide taxis.
Yeah. It's a facilitation.
Yeah.
It's kind of, and that's how, as I say, Uber... But then in fairness, I get Uber's argument in many respects, because it is exactly how every other taxi company has ever been run. They have...
But there are some acid tests, aren't there? And the Pimlico Plumbers judgment, ultimately, was quite clear in terms of, once the big hand of the employer starts to come in and dictate terms, you're no longer a worker, you're actually employed.
You're not self-employed, you're a worker.
Sorry, yes, sorry.
It's a massive distinction. Yes. But essentially the idea is this master-servant arrangement. That's what everybody's always looking for. So, when you start to say, right, this is the job you're going to do next, this is the uniform you're going to wear, this is the van you're going to drive, these are all the tools you're going to use, when you start to dictate that level, then invariably you're straying into a worker relationship.
And Pimlico Plumbers had done exactly that, I believe, hadn't they? They had told this person what jobs they were going to be doing, and then after they'd, and if that person was also to leave the brokerage agreement, whatever it was that you want to call it, they wouldn't be able to work for one of their competitors.
Yes, yeah.
So they wanted to control their relationship after the event.
Yeah, it is one of those things when you start to drill down into what actually was going on behind the scenes and not the facade that the business wanted to show you, then it did look very much like a working relationship. And that's exactly why Pimlico lost at every single stage.
Because you have a level of control, in other words.
Yeah.
Over certain aspects of that relationship, then you're a worker.
Absolutely,
rather than
there was one other important point in that judgment, and that related to the issue of substitution. And it was something that had come up previously with Deliveroo and a couple of these others, where it was said in the contract that the worker had the right to substitute themselves for somebody else. So if they didn't want to do the job for whatever reason, in varying cases, one was we'd have to confirm that we're happy with the suitability of that person. The other was we don't care. And in the instance where we don't care too much, you're not exercising that control, that was very much more a factor around self-employment as opposed to being a worker. Right. Mm-hmm. Where you're exercising control over the substitutes, then that's more worker than self-employed. Mm-hmm. So Pimlico Plumbers did do something to clarify that, at least, that actually the substitution point isn't as much of a determining factor as we once
thought. But he's still not happy, is he? Because he's now talking about taking it to an even higher European court.
Pimlico Plumbers at their desk, where they are talking about it. Whether they'll do it or not
remains
to be seen.
And the reason behind all of that, of course, is he now can't afford his brand new Bentley. I don't know if you ever
allegedly
did you ever see the documentary that Bentley did that was put out last year, because he was actually on it. And they'd given him one of those awful new 4x4 things that they'd come out with to drive about in, and he was actually in the program, wasn't he?
My issue with all of this is that, once again, we were talking earlier about the pace of change, and once again, in my opinion, is the government hasn't caught up with how things are going. The gig economy is here to stay, no matter what the government feel or think. The thing that they haven't done is thought about what it is they do. They're just fighting a rearguard action. What, if you look at what's happening, is people are thinking up ways of getting around stuff, yeah, implementing it, and then the government are trying to take them to court while they busily think about ways of stopping them doing it. How about rethinking what you're doing in the first place? Nearly every one of these things boils down to one of two factors, and I'm looking at you, Emma, for you to go, no, you're wrong, Paul. Yeah, it boils down to one of two factors. Employers' rights, yeah, so maternity leave, paternity leave, paid holiday, sickness pay, da-da-da-da, on the one hand.
Yep. Employee rights, you mean?
Employee rights, yeah. And the payment of employers' national insurance, yeah. And employers' national insurance is the easiest thing in the world to solve. Incorporate it in tax, yeah. Instead of having two, actually there's four, because there's, you know, tier four employers, national insurance and all the rest of it. Instead of having all these tiers of national insurance, scrap the whole thing and roll it over all into one tax. Then people can't avoid it. Yeah. It's really not difficult. The issue comes in terms of whether you have employee rights or not. And we haven't got much longer, I'm afraid, Emma, but I want to ask you about zero-hour contracts, because I spend far too much of my life arguing with people about zero-hour contracts and what they are. And I'll just make a couple of statements before you talk. There are only 2.8% of the workforce on zero-hour contracts in this country, and 31% of them are full-time students. Yeah, it isn't the issue that a lot of people think it is. But also, a lot of people are fooled by the fact that because you're on a zero-hour contract, you've got no rights. But that's not true, is it?
That's not true. No,
you are a fully accredited worker.
Yep.
On a zero-hour contract.
Yep. Yeah. You are. You don't have the full suite of rights that an employee has, but you do have rights not to suffer detriment in relation to discrimination. You're entitled to have holiday pay.
Yep.
So there are a range of rights that you do still have as a zero-hour worker. They are controversial, but perhaps, arguably wrongly, there are plenty of employees that take the view, or workers that take the view, that the flexibility it affords them is priceless.
61%.
I wouldn't even begin to know the figure, but as I say, a lot of them will say the flexibility is what they're after, suits them.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the same applies to all the Ubers and everybody else that works at Deliveroo, and, you know, not all of them, I'm sure, but certainly some of them have the attitude that...
How did they come into being in the first place? Was it a change of law that they were created?
Zero-hour contracts? No, there was no change in law. It was just that somebody realised that there was this limb B in Section 203 of the Employment Rights Act
and
took advantage of the fact that you don't have to have an employment relationship.
Right.
It's not necessary.
Mm. The interesting thing is, it's a little bit of an invention, to be honest, because we've had piecework and all of that kind of work for 200 years. The whole of London used to decamp and pick hops and stuff during the summer.
Yeah.
That's just zero-hour contract work, It's just that we started to name it. And once we'd labelled it, everybody went, hold on a minute, that's not good.
But then, you know, and then the Employment Rights Act 96...
Right.
Sort of set it out so that there's two tiers. There's employees with full employment rights, and then there are workers who have less employment rights, but some nonetheless.
Right.
Yeah.
And then, as I say, beyond that, self-employed with none.
I'm just going to ask Emma one more very quick question, because I happen to know that you're involved in a massive case at the moment. Now, I don't expect you to divulge any information.
Oh, come on.
I mean, it's in the tens of millions, but what aspect of law is that focusing in on, just out of interest?
Oddly enough, given your interest in construction, it is construction law.
Right.
Is it?
Yeah, it's a huge construction dispute. Mm.
Right. Are you acting for the employer or employee?
We're not. This is an arbitration commercial situation.
Right.
So we are assisting a main contractor against a subcontractor.
Oh, right, okay.
Right, okay.
Interesting stuff.
Yeah.
Well, next time you come on, you can tell us all about that.
Emma, thank you so much for that. It's a fascinating set of topics. There's arguments to go on forever with
it's
this, I'm afraid.
Huge
you know,
area.
I don't think there is any real solution to any of this, because as fast as people come up with one area of law, somebody will find another loophole for a little while.
There's no certainty in law.
You can tell what side of the fence he sits on, though, can't you? Citizen Smith, the revolution.
No. From my point of view, the problem we have, looking at the changing nature of the world, is that our employment regulations, based on mostly on the taxation of it, are completely out of kilter with what we need for the future.
Yeah.
And so far, the government has done everything to try and change the law on the other side rather than address the taxation issues. I spent a long time working on IR35 when I had a business involved where a lot of our people were caught in IR35. And the fact is, there's an incredibly vanishingly simple way of solving the problem that HMRC had with that, which is to have a different category of personal service company. If they did that with a rolled over national insurance, there wouldn't be an issue at all.
No.
Anyway, we could argue about that forever. But for the moment, Emma Lee of Jarman Solicitors, thank you so much for joining
us.
If people want to find out about your law firm, what's your website?
It is www.jarmans.co.uk, I think.
Fantastic. It is indeed. And there is a link on our website.
Oh, please tell me there is.
Yeah. At Jarman Souls.
On the Twitter.
On the Twitter.
Absolutely. Cool.
You know more than I do.
Yeah. we're going to talk to David because we're fast approaching the end of the show, really. But I just want to tell you about another event that's happening later in the year to get you ready for this. And it's following on the success of last year's Gorillas and Gowns charity fashion show. Butterflies Events is excited to announce the Chimps and Tricks charity event. It's going to be taking place at Port. Yeah, you're going to love this. It's going to be taking place at Portland Hotel near Hythe on Thursday, the 19th of October, from 6 p.m. till 11:30 p.m. And they're raising funds to support the Aspinall Foundation Megafauna Project. Hosted by Amanda Flanders of Butterflies Events and Paul Andrews, oh, that'll be me, of the Business Bunker Radio Show, in collaboration with Jane Mucklow of Jane Mucklow Photography. Guests will be welcomed with a glass of bubbly and canapes in the stunning setting of the main house before moving to the marquee for a mixture of great entertainment, mouth-watering food, an auction. I'm the auctioneer, with lots of exciting pledges and then dancing the night away with the fabulous Jason Allen Sway and his swing band. Amanda has gathered together a great variety of Kent entertainment for the evening to excite and delight you with three amazing magicians who will be working the room, blowing your mind with their skills, and a couple of casino tables to test your luck out.
Sounds good.
During the evening, you'll be continually supplied with the most delicious food from the fabulous Chives caterers, and then you'll get the chance to bid on the auction pledges that take your fancy. Our entertainment, who are kindly, they're all donating their time free for this. Our magicians are Stu Weller, Rob Scott and Neil Edward. The casino is supplied by Dan Smith at Ace Casinos, and the music is by Jason Allen Sway and his swing band. We are raising money for the Aspinall Foundation's Megafauna Project, a project established to reintroduce the regionally extinct mandrill and a reinforcement to the low number of chimpanzees in the Bateke Plateau region.
Yeah.
Okay. Tickets just £55 per person. Group bookings of six or more is only £50. And every single penny is going to the fund. If you want to find out more details, butterfliesbusinessevents.co.uk/what's on.
What date's that, Paul?
It's October, Thursday the 19th of October.
Right, okay.
Yeah. Last year we did Gorillas and Gowns and we rehomed four gorillas. We raised £6,000 on the night and it was absolutely fabulous. It was an absolutely fabulous evening and we're looking forward to bigger and better this year.
Emma has just passed me her mobile phone.
Lucky you.
And I said I would read this out very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Tuesday, the 18th of September, 10 till 12, Jarmans are hosting an FSB roundtable event to discuss the importance of road infrastructure to you and your business. So this is all around the Lower Thames proposed Lower Thames crossing.
Yeah.
So if you'd like to have your voice heard, and I'm sure there'll be some very important people there from the LEP and local government, that information and all those details are on Eventbrite. But again, if you get in touch with Jarman Solicitors directly at Jarman Souls on the Twitter, that'll be a great one to go to, I'm sure. That's Tuesday the 18th of September, 10 a.m. till 12.
Okay, I just need to make a correction to the Chimps and Tricks. It's not a Thursday, it's a Friday. It's Friday the 19th.
Fine.
I thought that was a bit odd. There you go. Friday the 19th of October.
Let's talk to David.
Let's talk to our next guest.
David, welcome.
Hello.
QBH Solutions, David Burton.
Hmm.
So, David, my father used to work in the aircraft industry. And I would imagine
my dad knew Lord Kitchener.
Well,
no, that's not. It's just one of those statements, isn't it?
No, I've got a link that's relevant.
Okay,
you clearly haven't.
Yeah.
And I would imagine that in the aircraft industry, quality management systems are paramount to keep planes
they can kill
and
us.
Stop them breaking down. So, with that, tell us a little bit about what you do at QBH.
my dad, knew Lord Kitchener, and aeroplanes need quality. Well, how do I follow that? Right, OK. ISO 9001:2015 is the new standard for quality assurance, and it came from originally, believe it or not, Japan, and then very quickly adopted by the Americans along production lines to standardise the process of manufacture. Yeah. Bring that forward, roll that forward to 2015, to the new standard, current standard, I should say, and that's about quality assuring your business processes. So whether it's service, whether it's manufacturing, whatever it's you're doing, is how can you get the... I'm stepping a bit far away from the microphone. How can you assure the quality of the services that you're providing?
Right, so that's a consistent output every time you turn on a machine or you go through a process or whatever it is.
Which is relatively easy to do with a production line, with a factory, but when you're in the service industry, when you're using people to provide that service, it becomes a little bit harder to maintain that consistency, and that's where that standard really comes into its own.
And I would imagine that overlaps with what you get involved with ultimately, Emma, as well. In, you know, if that breaks down and you can't manage that process because it is people intensive, ultimately there's going to be some friction there, I guess, isn't there? Something's going to need to be fixed. So it's a very interesting area, isn't it?
It is, and as David intimated there, at the moment in the UK, 80% of our economy is service based, and that will continue to grow in that direction as time unfolds. And making effective processes and quality standards for services is actually a lot harder than doing it for production. Yeah. From you as a business, David, at the moment, your quality services, do you primarily handle manufacturing, or is it exclusively services, or is it a mixture?
It's about a 85-15 split service to manufacturing. So most of our clients are service
businesses. Okay, yeah. Which kind of makes sense these days in the way that the market is.
Give us an example of a client that you're working with in a service industry for whom, you know, having an ISO accreditation is vital to their business.
I'll take one of our big clients up in town, just in the Old Bailey. They came to me about 18 months ago. They've been going for about 20-25 years. They put consultants into different industry sectors, predominantly oil, gas, construction, environmental. The business has seen various different manifestations. It's been bought out, it's moved on, it's grown forward. So they've got a system, a management system, if you like, which is quality, safety, environment, which is about 20-25 years old. And that system has grown, and it grew to nearly 1,000 different documents. We've now whittled that down to 200 key documents, most of which are forms, and down to 12 key processes within the business. They're quite big processes, but we've pulled it right down. That system is subject to annual surveillance audits, a three-year certification audit. They need those certificates. They need to have those certificates on the wall to be able to provide those services in that industry.
Because when they tender for business, one of the prerequisites, probably a pre-qual tender, have you got X, Y, and Z accreditations?
Do you have ISO 9001, yes or no? Yes, skip this section and go to the next one.
Yeah. Well,
if you say no, you've then got maybe another 10 pages to fill.
That's what I think is really interesting, because bringing that back to kind of small businesses and Kent, I think one of the biggest obstacles that a lot of small businesses have when they go for public procurement, for example, and above, I think, what is it, above £12,000, everything goes on a procurement website if it's kind of public money. One of the biggest obstacles is actually having that accreditation in place as a small business. So how can you help small businesses get that accreditation so that they're actually able to go for a bigger slice of the pie?
A number of different ways. I mean, you may not necessarily see the value of that certification. We argue that if you're going to do it, if you're going to get that system in place, it can do much more than just be something on the wall for your business. It can it can help you with your HR processes. It can prevent liquidation. You're looking at the risks of the business. You're looking at the complete every single area of your business, and then trying to systemize it, which then provides or affords a level of protection. We help businesses primarily micro and smaller businesses. We deal with a couple of big corporates as well, but we tend to help the smaller businesses because they're the ones that struggle to implement it. The bigger businesses have teams of departments that can implement it. The smaller guys and girls out there, they don't. So they come to us.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because it comes back to the point that we were making earlier, that so many small businesses try to avoid all this stuff because it all seems like a big faff and expensive and blah, blah, blah. But I went through the process of having to get ISO 9001 because I had a business that dealt almost exclusively with big companies. And the first thing they said is, if you haven't got this, you can't even tender for the contract. And we go, oh, Jesus, do we really need this? Yep, is the answer. The interesting thing about going through the process is how many other things that fed into. Yeah, how many things it forced you to look at your business and look at how you do your business and go, actually, we really shouldn't be doing it like this, or we should be doing it like that.
Do
you find that quite often when you go to look at something?
One of the first things that I do is talk, or one of my team does, is we go and talk to the business owner. What's the first thing that happens? So somebody picks up the phone or sends you an email or an inquiry comes in through the website. What happens to that inquiry? How does that become a quote, maybe? How does that then go into some sort of order system? Where's your purchase order? Where's that bit of paper saying, yes, please proceed? Have you got it? Have you filed it? Have you kept it? Through to then the service delivery, what sort of other bits and pieces do you need to be able to provide that service? So what stock levels have you got? Have you got key suppliers? How does that work? All the way through to delivering the service or the product, final payment, and then feedback. It's getting people to think about that journey.
So systemizing your business and creating lean processes or processes that are as lean as possible, to actually manage that.
Even before you get to the point about creating processes, it's a great way of understanding what the hell it is you do, because quite often you don't think about it. You don't think about the steps that are involved in a business because you just go, the customer comes in and we slap it over there or whatever. Yeah, but how do you do that?
That's a good point, isn't it? Because businesses have thrown bodies at problems, I think. You know, there hasn't been the investment necessarily in the kind of the infrastructure.
It's one of my theories about why productivity is so low in the UK. We have this really interesting thing at the moment that we have really low productivity. Yet everyone I know works 24 hours a day. You know, their phone goes off 20. And you think, how on earth can people be working more and more hours and be getting less and less productive? And I think there's an answer there.
One of the things that we really enjoy, me, Angie, in the office as well, is when we go and talk to a client, we map it out, we go back, we show it to them and say, this is what you've described. And we'll say, well, why are you doing that when you've got these stages here? Kind of tandem systems, tandem, without getting too nerdy about it. You're running three or four systems when you only need to run one. And they go, oh, don't think about that.
So you can show that visually on a diagram, and then it all makes perfect sense, doesn't it?
I mean,
so.
Back of a fag pack, you know, your notebook. Why are we doing that? And already we're changing that process before we've even put it into a computer. Right. It can add value, and it's something that we get a lot of joy from doing.
So as a kind of as a business process benefit, productivity, all of that, but actually it can also open the doors to tendering for contracts to ultimately take your business to the next level as well. So it's a double whammy, isn't it, really?
Well, quite a few, I would say probably most, large organisations, when they go out to tender for a contract, will insist that you have those kind of quality standards in place. But even if they don't, actually having them actually counts as a benefit when you do quote for the business, I would say.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, there's other standards out there that we work with businesses on that procurement teams within the organisations want to see. So data security is quite relevant at the moment, environmental health and safety, as well as quality. The theory is, without getting too nerdy about it, again, the procurement regulations changed a couple of years ago, 2015, to try and open up these contracts to smaller micro businesses, because the theory is that there's a lot of small businesses out there that are providing fantastic services, fantastic products. They can't get a piece of this cake, they can't get into this chain.
Yeah, absolutely.
So they've changed those rules and regulations, but they're still asking for businesses to have some of these systems. And I think that's a good thing, because if you can make that commitment, it doesn't have to be expensive, it doesn't have to be a lot of time, because if you can do it in the right way, you're getting value in so many different areas.
So the $6 million question is, how much does it cost? I mean, I know that's impossible to answer.
To you, Martin, a pound.
I'm happy to offer discounts to our friends on Supply My Business. It varies. Your certification costs. It's interesting. I was having a chat this morning. There's different types of certification bodies out there. We encourage our clients to consider using UCAS registered certification bodies. So they've got to satisfy a set of criteria, objectivity, that kind of stuff. So that can cost from between £15,000 to £3,000 every 3 years.
Right.
So say £1,000 a year from a certification point of view. Our systems, we can work quite reasonably from about 2.5 upwards. Again, depends on size, complexity. We can do as much or as little as the business owner wants. We can go in and do everything, or we can go in and allocate tasks to the business owner to go away and do themselves. And we can keep the cost down that way if that's something
right.
We want to do.
One of the interesting things here about all of these kind of things, and it's kind of coming back to something that Emma was saying earlier as well, it strikes me that by investing in these kind of things, it also shows willing that you've actually looked at what you've done. And what I mean by that is, if you think about something like GDPR, which is another fiasco that has been thrown on us, not that I want to be controversial here, but it's, and if you think that's bad, wait until they try and implement Article 13, because that's just insane. Yeah. But anyway, it is what it is. We've been dumped on by it. Everybody's got it wrong. In my opinion, everybody sent millions of emails going, oh, do you want to stay a subscriber? GDPR's got nothing to do with staying on an email list. But anyway, neither here nor there. But one of the things is, by doing the kind of things that you're suggesting, David, if you get into trouble with anybody, at least you can show you've made an effort to put some things in place and to start to understand the processes and the kind of things you're doing. You know, because so many businesses don't have any idea, and that's where they come unstuck, because they, you know, and you made the point right up front, Emma, it's about communication, but it's about communicating to your people about the importance of data and other people's data, and the importance of processes, and importance of knowing what the systems are that you have in place to do things, and what the structure of doing those things is. And one of the things I liked about what you said was about micro businesses getting into this right up front, because I think if there's an easy and low cost way of getting into it, then there's no excuse for not doing it. And then once you're into it, you grow with it as a business.
Every single one of our clients, bar none, has grown since they've taken on, say, one of our systems. It's not our systems, it's their systems. Because it's given them the information. It churns out facts, figures, metrics to work out whether your business is working effectively or not.
Which comes exactly back to what Adrian was saying about, you know, knowing what your costs are, knowing what your overheads are, knowing what the value of your business is, and knowing how much you can charge for it. Yeah. It's not really rocket... Well, it is rocket science, but it's not really rocket science, really, is it? It's just being structured about what you're doing. Yeah,
definitely. It's interesting you said rocket science, because that's go to a regular networking group down in Folkestone, and we have a tagline, and our tagline is HR and compliance doesn't have to be rocket science. So thanks for that.
That's all right, yeah. I like setting these things up, yeah. Mind you, if it is rocket science, it could be quite useful, couldn't it? Yeah. So we've got a couple of minutes left, David. So kind of developing what you do as a business. How long have you been in business?
I've been in QBH up 3 years ago.
Okay.
3 years ago in May.
Okay.
And we had our third birthday, which was good fun. We've got a little office down in Base Point, down in Shearway Road in Folkestone. It's three of us in the team at the moment. We're looking to maybe expand that compliance support a little bit further as well. I've just put the business plan and the marketing plan together.
He's got a plan.
I like to say that.
He has since he met Adrian, anyway.
He'd be right by him. What's one here?
He's literally just written it.
To use your fag packet.
Yeah. Get more clients.
And on the other side, he's got a contract of employment. Yeah.
But the other thing that's crucial to what David does that we haven't touched on, if you as a small business owner want to sell your business at some point, that business has got to survive without you. Now, as a prospective buyer, if I'm looking to buy a business, and actually without the business owner that business has no chance of surviving, then I'm not going to
buy anything.
It's as simple as that. You know, because I can't buy you, so therefore I can't buy your business. So you know, the systems that you're talking about here are critical, aren't they, to make a business ultimately viable as a going concern without you, the business owner, in it.
It's like creating something bigger than yourself. But that, again, a healthy number of our clients come to us because they've decided they want to step away from the day-to-day running of the business. It's becoming a little bit too stressful, it's becoming a little bit too big, or it's an exit strategy. You know, they want to sell this thing, and the advisors, the financiers, if you like, that are going to support that would insist that they've got some sort of systemization in place to be allowed to take it out of the senior team's head, put it on paper, because that's where that information is.
So actually that should be a fundamental part of your business plan, shouldn't it?
It should.
You know, there should be a line on your business plan that says, you know, quality management system.
Mm.
You know, and there should be a budget against that.
Absolutely. And your point, I think, is incredibly valid, Martin, which is really unusual for me.
Steady on. Let us say the best contribution.
Exactly. He's made after 5 years, he's finally made a valid contribution. I'm absolutely gobsmacked.
He's only saying that because my sponsorship's coming up.
he's really lovely. Yeah. I think it's very valid, this exit plan thing. You know, you should always have to, you know, all those kind of things need to be in place because people aren't stupid. If you put it in place a week before you sell it, they go, yeah, you just done that. Yeah, you haven't thought about this before. But it really is crucially important, that, you know, because I'll tell you very quickly a quick story. I was approached a couple of years ago to buy a business, and the couple that was selling it wanted to retire, and they wanted to retire desperately, and they didn't want to do an earn out, and it was a service business. And I'm going, but hold on a minute, you know, you're flogging me something. How much do you want for this? £1 million? Oh, really? And you don't want to work it anymore. You want me to buy it for £1 million and you want to walk away the next day. That ain't going to happen. And you've got nothing in place for me to run this business or anything. I'm going to just be phoning you up every 10 minutes. And I said, quite frankly, your business isn't worth more than £200,000. And that is the maximum I'll give it to you. And under the circumstances you want, I'm not giving you more than 100,000. And they laughed and they walked away. And sadly, and this is really sad, they ended up selling the business about 6 months ago for 40 grand.
Oh.
Because they just got to the point when, you know, they just had to retire because they were getting so old. And it was just sad. And all of that could have been avoided if they'd have, you know, looked at some of these issues much sooner and much earlier on.
Think about the benefit of doing it on day one as well, from a kind of a learning by your kind of mistakes.
Yeah,
you know, benefit point of view. You know, I mean, you'll make far fewer mistakes if you have something like that in place.
It's definitely easier to put a system in from scratch and allow it to grow with the business.
Yeah.
Either way, we can help.
David, thank you so much for that. We've kind of reached the end of the show. 2 hours has gone already. I'm getting loads of messages telling me to shut up.
You haven't asked David how we get in touch.
I'm just about to.
Well, hurry up and get on to it.
I'm just about to ask David what his website address is.
If I wasn't here, this show would be going on till midnight.
So, David, how can we get hold of you?
All the W's, qbhsolutions.co.uk, and Twitter at @QBHLimited.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. Just want to tell you, coming up on Friday is our sister show, the Business Bunker Extra Show, presented by Amanda Flanders. And this week, her co-host is cybersecurity specialist Richard Bell, and their guest is Tracy Ferguson. So do tune in to the Bunker Extra Show, 11 a.m. on Friday. I want to say a massive thank you to our three guests today, Mr. Adrian Dente of McIntyre Hudson, the lovely Emma Lee from Jarman Solicitors, and David Burton from QBH, and my co-host, Mr. Marvis Martin White. Thank you all so much for joining us on the Business Bunker show. We will be back next Tuesday with another show. In the meantime, have a fabulous week, and we'll see you all soon. And bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
The Business Bunker with Paul Andrews.